Hi, my name is Thomas Johnson, and I'm the founder and CEO of Get Up and Get Fit Wellness Concierge. I'm also a C-suite advisor and investor. And you're listening to the How May I Serve You podcast, where I'm constantly on the quest to surround myself with the best coaches while learning how to better serve our executive clientele by asking them, how may I serve you? Today's show is sponsored by Get Up and Get Fit. Get Up and Get Fit will be providing students with textbooks and school supplies in Cambodia in honor of our guest today, as well as our philanthropic mission to impact at least 50,000 people per year. And today's guest is Dr. Omar Clark Fisher. Dr. Clark, how you doing?
Excellent. Thanks. From Seattle.
Yes, indeed. Cold, cold Seattle. So Dr. Omar Clark Fisher is a serial entrepreneur in the Islamic economy over a span of 40 plus years. Dr. Omar is a recognized pioneer in Islamic finance and tactical and co-founder of 9 startups in the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the UAE. He is an avid tennis player, ocean sailor, and writes poetry whenever an inspiration hits deeply. Okay. He is the author of several books, numerous chapters in other books, published articles, and international reports, plus a series of ebooks, okay, on seeking knowledge and consciousness. Okay. So seeking knowledge and consciousness. So that's your topic right there, huh?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is, Thomas. And it's a pleasure to be here, to have the opportunity to address your C-suite and others who choose to listen in and learn from the various guests that you interview. I'd like to talk today about a concept of conscious wealth and how these actually fit together.
Okay, okay. So Dr. Omar, before we get started towards that direction, let's dive a little bit more into your story, right? Where are you from? Where were you born? And what got you started in this direction?
Sure, Thomas. So I was born in the education capital of the world, Boston, Massachusetts, and was raised there and enjoyed ice hockey. So I'm a competitor. I like to score.
Nice.
And from there, I also, of course, learned sailing, ocean sailing to Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, and some places further south, South Carolina, et cetera. And what a great place to grow up and to have these blessings, basically, participate in team sports and also, as I just mentioned, to be out in nature. And in fact, that's one of the things that drew me after 22 years in the Gulf between 2000 and 2022. I was in the desert. That's one of the things that drew me back to the Pacific Northwest is the greenery and being part of nature.
Nice.
I came through the Newton school system, eventually went to Yale University, where, much to the chagrin of my dad, who was a Yale graduate as an engineer, I chose to study English literature and poetry.
Okay.
In fact, my senior dissertation was on an analysis of the poetry of my teacher, Mark Strand, a live poet that came up from Soho every Thursday.
Nice.
So that was kind of a courageous or reckless thing to do, is to write a master's dissertation, so to say, at that level on my own teacher, right? But anyway, I survived that. And eventually joined Arthur D. Little as a management consultant, the oldest and in many ways most respected management consulting and innovation lab in the United States, dating back to 1888. And ADL sent me as part of my work to Cairo, Egypt, on a transformation project of the Egyptian phone company. So that was quite a change from, you know, the East Coast to being in really a historic civilization. It was there that I came to understand the tenets of Islam, and I embraced Islam, and that started my journey as a bit of a business expert in the area of finance, and helped me come back to the U.S. and build an equipment leasing company in the 90s. I also matriculated and joined the Overseas Private Investment Corporation in Washington, where I serve the interests of mid-size and larger American corporations looking for investment capital and political risk insurance guarantees into various emerging markets. I was responsible to put together almost $1 billion of investment guarantees and learned a lot about the structure of deals, the use of capital, the risks, of course, of investing abroad. And I used that then to seed some of my other ventures, which you alluded to.
Today's episode is sponsored by Get Up and Get Fit. Being an executive can be very demanding. Your schedule is unpredictable. You have conflicting responsibilities that pull you in multiple directions at once. You travel too much, work late hours, and cross time zones. All things that wreak havoc on your body. This is why having a wellness support team is necessary. Get Up and Get Fit is the wellness concierge support that busy executives, entrepreneurs, and celebs rely on to keep them healthy and fit despite their hectic schedules. A body under prolonged stress is not a healthy body. Time to reduce your stress. Increase your energy, flexibility, strength, and endurance so you can enjoy life instead of just living it. Go to getupandgetfit.com. That's GETUPNGETFIT.com. And schedule your consultation right now. Get up and get fit. It's a lifestyle.
So let's dive further into your experience in Egypt, right? And I mentioned earlier that you have over 40 years, of experience as an entrepreneur in Islamic economy over a span of 40 plus years. So what have you learned just being in that area, right? Coming from the East Coast, Boston, and going all the way towards like Cairo, Egypt. Like, talk to me about your experience further.
Sure. Well, one of the main things, Thomas, which I came to fully understand, and it starts in the heart, of course, okay? Not just understanding intellectually, but to take it in and make some of the learning part of who I am. So it's a spiritual matter as well as a matter of real world. And what I mean by that is the importance of structuring equity. The importance of risk sharing rather than risk transfer. Now, this is an important and very basic tenet, set of principles about money, which I bring forward into the work I'm currently doing about conscious wealth. And I'm an advisor to a company called DFinance, which is helping our graduates out of school, carrying very onerous debts, education finance debts, helping them out of the debt and replacing it with an income sharing structure. So one of the things, going back to Cairo and from there into Islamic finance, is lending is not allowed. Lending at any premium is not allowed. You can lend, but then as the creditor, you expect only your principal back.
So no interest.
So if we look at debt today, particularly all of the predominance of how various forms of credit and debt have permeated our society, not just the business transactions. So we have, actually, I mentioned a moment ago, the student finance. This is the second largest form of debt in America, second only to mortgages. And when we saddle our recent graduates with the average is $37,000, but it could, for a practicing nurse or a lawyer, it could be $120,000, could be $180,000. We saddle our recent graduates with that amount of debt, which must be repaid. That's one thing about debt. You can't wish it away, right?
Yeah.
So there's got to be a better way. And this realization comes directly out of the experiences that I'm blessed to have gone through in Egypt and subsequent to Egypt when I built a leasing company, a medical equipment leasing company here in the U.S. in the 90s, is how important it is to, let's say, be resourceful in the capital structure, not only of your household, right, but of your business, and what options are there and could be availed of outside of debt. Debt, of course, has certain tax advantages, and there's all of this gigantic commercial banking and other lending industry that encourages us to believe that debt is okay, it's natural, but the fact remains, Thomas, that if you're a debtor, and I'll make it very simple, there's an upper hand and a lower hand. The debtor is always the lower hand.
True.
The upper hand is the financier. Now, how about if we had the entrepreneur or head of household alongside as a peer to the financier? And this, of course, is partly what goes on in the popularity of crowdfunding, for instance, mm-hmm. right? And the peer-to-peer financing that has done such wonderful work in the area of donations, for example. But I may be getting a little bit far afield. One of the things that I wanted to punctuate today with you is that 33% of Americans have actually saved less than $100,000 for their retirement. And medical expenses are forecasted these days to be in excess of $200,000 during the retirement period on average, which means it could be more, it could be less, right? Now, asset managers are quite clear, and they say that each one of us needs about $2 million
retirement
to have a so-called comfortable retirement.
Yeah.
At a 5% annual return on the 2 million, that's 100,000, that's about 8,000 and change a month to have a, you know, a comfortable retirement. So the real question is, are you ready? Are you on that trajectory in your relationship to your money so that whether you choose to retire at 42, I mean, there's no magic in 60 or 65, right? Again, I think there's some sort of conditioning out there that we all have to work hard, save as we can, and then retire. Well, why not aim to retire, and you can figure it all out. We can help if you wish. 46 and a half, you can retire. And then do what you really, really want to be doing with the precious time that our creator has given to each one of us.
Yes, indeed. So Dr. Umar, have you always been into finance? Has this been a topic that has always interested you since you were younger, or just like a more recent love for finance?
No, from the outset, I would say. Mm-hmm. After I mean, poetry is a continuous theme throughout, but I embraced this idea of finance, and I was curious about what the Islamic religion and other religions, Christianity, Judaism, what they all say about our relationship to the thing we call money.
Yeah.
I mean, that's at the heart of it. And then how that gets expressed in capital structures, in financial transactions, which I've mentioned along the way in this talk. But fundamentally, it comes back to the basic. And I have to say, Thomas, in the work that I did in the Middle East, in you could call it financial literacy, or what I prefer to call it is financial intelligence, is that most people have not probed their relationship with money. So, for example, I invented a game, which I call the game of money personality. So let me ask you, Thomas, do you know your money personality?
give me some personality
there
traits.
There are 10.
There are 10.
So
okay.
There's a guardian, for example. There's a spendthrift. There's a star. There's a builder. There's a philanthropist. There's a base saver, like this. Anyway, okay. I've come up with these games as a way to help individuals. They can be in the C-suite. They can be in the middle of the company. You know, we all, I think, can benefit from an exercise of examining more closely our relationship to the thing we call money. And this, by the way, Thomas, is becoming very, very, very important these days. And why? Because in the past 2,000 years, right, money was physical.
Yes, indeed.
It was change, coins, copper in your in your pocket. And if it was gone, you knew you couldn't spend anymore, right? But in the last, whatever, 100 years or so, we have created fractional banking. Yeah. And out of that, we've created this whole idea of credit rationing. And consequently, I believe people are beginning to lose touch with the concept of what money means to them. And money should not be an end goal. It should be a means goal. And by that, I mean, ask yourself, why do you need money? Why do you need the $2 million to retire? And when you probe that and get into it, you recognize that it's because money is a tool. Money is a facilitator. It enables you to feel a certain way when you're driving that convertible, you know, down an open road, or it enables you to travel comfortably, which creates experiences for you as an individual, right? And also memories, which you can share, right? But it also creates feelings. And human beings most often do things because of the feelings of success, the feelings of achievement. But coming back to the point, now what happens when money rapidly goes cashless? And then from cashless, it goes to digital. And from digital, it becomes poof, invisible.
Mm-hmm. That's what's happening.
Now, that's exactly what's happening. And with the CBDCs, over 100 countries now are exploring with those. And in the coming, they say 10 years, I think it'll be much faster, Thomas.
Yeah, adoption. I definitely believe that. Yeah. So Dr. Umar, what do you say to those individuals that have a problem with the money in terms of their mindset, right? Because we all know we tend to get in our own way. And there's something called learned helplessness, right? Might have grown up, we might have been around adults and peers who had this negative connotation when it comes to money, right? Like you hear the saying, money is root of evil, which is a butcher saying, which is not the truth, right? It's love of money is the root of all evil.
Yeah,
so you have these different saying, exactly. Right. So you have these mishaps and negative connotation that relates to money, and even in some household, you can't even talk about money or politics around the dinner table, right? So what do you say to the individuals that grew up into adults and now they have a hard time dealing with money because of that learned behavior, right?
Correct. Talk to me. That's a perfect opening. What Piaget, which I studied in graduate school, and Jerome Bruner, who among the theories of human cognitive learning, they say that a lot of the cognitive structure, which then conditions the habits of the human being, are gathered in the first 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the good news is this can be changed. However, it takes work. as Bob Proctor, God bless him, and Napoleon Hill and James Allen and many of the other great authors and hence leaders who have studied what makes a human being, quote, successful, right? And then offered some guidance on that to us. What they say is that the hardest work you can do is thinking. It's not digging ditches, okay? It's not even running a marathon, although that for some people can be fun, right? It's thinking. And don't confuse sort of musing and, you know, just activity of the mind. That's busyness. That's not thinking. So what I'm building toward, Thomas, is that you want to change your habits. The habits took years because they may have started, your relationship to money may have started with certain things at the home, as you suggest. Money was dirty. And by the way, if you, and with all respect to our Jamaican brothers and sisters, if you touch Jamaican money, you know that it's absolutely filthy from the hygienic point of view. And similarly, in some, you know, villages in Egypt, the same thing of the paper money, right? So if your mom told you, oh, Thomas, don't touch that. That money is dirty. Well, she cares about you and she's sending a message, but she doesn't realize she sent an additional message as well. And it might therefore be difficult for you to become a saver if you feel you make the connection that money is dirty. Mm-hmm. However, I repeat, it's possible when a person becomes self-aware. And then you decide what are the changes that you want to make in your habits. Then the real work begins. You have to practice. Jack Canfield, another great mentor of mine, says the rule of five, which is every day when you get up, you take the axe symbolically and you take five swings at the tree and eventually the tree will topple. I'm not, by the way, encouraging people to cut trees down, but symbolically.
Symbolically.
Right? So if you have trouble saving, then you create some jars or you create a separate saving account from your checking account. And the rule of thumb is pay yourself first. As the wages come in, you take a small part, $50, $500, $5,000, whatever you're capable, and you put it in the savings account. And keep in mind that saving is about wealth preservation. You're never going to get rich by saving. But it's difficult to move on to the next phase of investing
if you don't save
without you have a pool of capital, which comes from saving. So investing, you can think of it as the acceleration of savings. And of course, there is risks associated, which comes back to some of the teachings I learned in Egypt, which is that we want to have risk sharing, not risk transfer.
So what's the difference? Because you mentioned risk sharing and risk transfer. It seems the same, right? Because in terms of the words, but what's the difference?
Okay, excellent, excellent. Glad you raised that because it impacts on two areas. It impacts on lending and it impacts on risk protection, what we call insurance.
Okay.
And I've had the honor and the privilege of founding three mutual insurance companies from scratch. One in the United States in 1997, which is now gone. One in Saudi Arabia. And a third one, we raised $63 million, got a license from the Central Bank of Bahrain and created a regional mutual company, which didn't exist at that point in time in 2007. So the difference is that our dominant financial system today, Thomas, is about risk transfer. The whole derivative industry is built on that premise. And by the way, I don't want to ruin your day today, but do you realize the notional value of derivatives globally?
No, I'm not fully aware.
It's $660 trillion.
Mm.
The global GDP today is about 80 trillion. So you've got a 8x in risk transfer transactions. And the debacle of the Great Recession, 2009 to 12, whatever time frame you want to choose, was set not solely because of the subprime issue, but also because of the failure of a derivative-backed organization in UK. There isn't time to go into all the details, but it was undercapitalized to support the risks that it had taken on. So that's the potential disaster that can happen in risk transfer. Now, when you do your home mortgage, it's also risk transfer because you've given the ownership of the home, which notionally is in your name, but practically the bank owns it.
Mm-hmm.
And God forbid if something should go wrong with the payments on schedule, and there are rules about that and regulations, what constitutes default, et cetera, then the bank has the legal right to take it. So what's the difference? Also, let me just set this up, that stock companies, stock insurance companies, work on the principle of risk transfer.
Transfer.
Meaning,
okay,
you have your auto insurance, you pay a premium to the insurance company, and in exchange for accepting your money, the insurance company shareholders pool accepts the risk. Now, if we shift to risk sharing, what happens? Well, what happens is that the risk itself and the taker of the risk are on the same level. They're sharing. It's not a matter of transferring. All right. Now, what that looks like in the reverse order in the insurance field is mutuals. Now, fortunately, mutuals have been here in the United States since Ben Franklin created the first fire mutual in about 1840. And predates in the Nordic countries of Europe a few hundred years even before that. And what happens there is a mutual, as you might know, has no shareholders. It has only policyholders.
Mm-hmm.
So the policyholder pays that auto premium into a pool where he or she is also the owner. All right? And so you have more of a sense of community. You all rise and you all kind of maybe go down in bad years together. That's not the case with a shareholder company. Now, the way that the Islamic finance handles the home financing is that they buy it together. So it's actually capital from the bank and capital from the individual, and they own it together. And what happens is the individual rents the home and pays a little above the operating rent to buy additional shares of ownership.
Mm,
so
okay,
that over time, the renter slash owner is buying more and more equity. So when the time comes to sell the asset, guess what? The bank enjoys some of the capital gain or shares the risk of loss, right? So it's much more of an equal and non-inflationary relationship. I hope I've explained it briefly, but clearly.
Yeah, definitely. You were very thorough, and I like the way how you broke it down to the layman. So in terms of one trying to wrap the mind around just money management, right? What books would you recommend? For me personally, I like The Richest Man in Babylon. That was one of the books that really opened up my eyes to money management. The Richest Man in Babylon. Have you read? I'm pretty sure you've read it, right?
Well, actually, no, I haven't read that one.
Yeah.
Well, I would say that Rich Dad Poor Dad by
Robert
Kurosawa is a good one to start. Although I have to also add that I don't agree with his overemphasis on real estate. Yeah. And the manner in which he would choose to finance real estate, which is debt. He uses a lot of debt leverage. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend we go in a different route. But yes, real estate is, as you know, and your audience knows, is one of the important and proven building blocks of wealth. I would also say that Tony Robbins did a book on mastering.
Yep. I haven't read it in my library.
Where he went out and very clever, and he interviewed the major money manager. Yeah, it's a bit hefty. you know, Warren Buffett and some of the other greats. And so the purpose of reading a book, okay, Thomas, the purpose of reading a book is you can save time. Sometimes you can save years, right? Mm-hmm. By learning from others, which is one of the main reasons I watch podcasts, for the exact same reason, right? So it's not always about reading books. It's sometimes being able to interact with some very interesting and knowledgeable people who can, you know, give you tips and hints and get you thinking in a particular direction maybe that you were not as clear on. And I have a couple of things I'd like to share in that regard. Perhaps as we get to wrapping up, which is you like to ask a question of the people you interview is, what am I doing to improve myself?
Yeah, that's a question right there. I tend to ask midway. So it's in terms of your daily practices, right? Because you have a very, very lavish background and expertise because you live in different regions, you ran various companies. What does your current day look like, right? As a, you know, investor, as a person that helps to provide a mentorship for certain companies, what does a typical day look like right now?
Okay. Thank you, Thomas. Well, a typical day, I start actually with my practice of gratitude.
Okay.
I take maybe upwards of 10 minutes, not more than that. And I just contemplate, and this I'm not embarrassed to say, I picked up years ago by watching and listening to Tony Robbins. He has a very precise, which he's since put on a video, so you can find it on YouTube. I've adapted it, of course, but I think it's very important that when we wake up, that's a gift.
It is.
And so we should start each day with being grateful. And also, I happen to use this practice, Thomas, where I name every part of my body.
Okay.
And I give thanks that they are doing their natural and normal job. So that's part of that practice. And then I go to the office, home office or wherever. And at the moment, a lot of my time in the day is drawn into the dfinance.com with the outreach to our graduates, which, by the way, are 48 million in America.
Oh, wow.
Today.
Okay.
The amount of debt which has accumulated is $1.7 trillion. Now, if we take the graduates in the private sector, because, of course, the bulk of it, about 80%, is in the public sector under the Department of Education. But in the private sector, which is more our focus, it's about 8 million. And that's $330 billion is needed to help these young graduates to pay off their debts. And yeah. So our focus is on how to do that efficiently, how to do that in a way which will leave these graduates literally, Thomas, debt-free. All right? Now, debt-free is a mental, it's a mindset, as well as something on the balance sheet, right?
Got it. So, what are your thoughts on leveraging? Because I know you're not a big fan of leveraging credit, right? But there is ways and means to leverage credit where you are earning points You're earning dollar for dollar in terms of your transactions. So what are your thoughts on that, those types of strategies?
Well, again, I would come to what is the purpose, okay? And we have essentially two purposes. We have consumption and we have production. So credit for production, that, you know, that can be justified, let's say. Obviously, the production needs to be healthy, needs to be legal. You know, there are certain considerations should be part of the ESG now, because we've got, you know, so many climate issues, environmental issues. So we can't just be selfish in terms of how we, quote, make money, it seems to me. So there's that. That's on the production. Now, on the consumption, some people have no choice.
Yeah, survival.
Sadly, the way things go in certain places, certain communities, is that people can't eat if they don't use credit. And this is very sad. And I think there are some solutions for that, but not within the podcast. There's no time to explore it.
Got it.
So one has to be very cautious about using credit for consumption. Now, if the consumption is extravagant, and of course, I'm not against you buying a luxury item if you deserve it and if you have the cash, right?
Yeah.
But to put luxury items, so how many pairs of shoes do you have, Thomas?
A few.
Okay. My boys,
yeah,
they've got, you know, like people their age, okay, they've got maybe a dozen. Well, a long time ago, you only needed like two
right? pairs.
Okay. One for everyday work and then one maybe to go to church or whatever. You get the idea. Special occasions. So we have, again, that's conditioning. That's the advertising world telling us what we, quote, need.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a need to have 12 or 15. Unless you're a collector, that's different. Okay. It's a want. And it's easy to confuse wants and needs. And that's coming all the way back to something I said earlier about self-awareness.
Yes, indeed. So with all of this work you're doing, you know, what's the driving force? What drives you? Why are you still doing this? Why not just retire and hang out in comfort and just enjoy the horror? That your hard time and money earned?
Well, that's a great question. And the simple answer is that I'm here to serve, like you. I mean, you have chosen to have this idea of how can I serve you to be the point of focus of your business. But you couldn't have even gotten that far, Thomas, if I could suggest, if it wasn't first in your heart. Okay. And even if you build a business around that, you have to get out of bed in the morning. You have to wake up with the passion to continue to put vitality into that proposition, correct?
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So for me, it's about service. It's about contribution. And actually, as a practicing Muslim, I would say that we also believe in the concept of accountability. And accountability means that we get to accumulate good deeds, right? In addition to the sins that come along the way, all of us, I think, are not immune to that. And the accountability is also, what have you done with the gifts that I was given? And some of those gifts is not only the knowledge, but it's the experience, it's my network, my ability to communicate and to write. So in fact, if I don't take it, the ideas, and then share it, I'm going to be accountable for that. And let me just drop a seed here, Thomas, maybe for another podcast, is in that vein, you asked what I'm doing in the day. So part of my day, I have a small part where I do my thinking, I do my strategic ideation. I open myself up to, we hope we can call it inspiration. And I'm working on a really interesting concept, which I'd love to, you know, share with your good self and others, which is called, but this is a code name. It might change.
It's okay? A code name.
I'm calling it Psychic Capital.
Psychic Capital. Okay.
So I'm looking for a way to incentivize people, coming back to the core of our talk together, away from debt, away from being the lower hand, to using equity, to using leasing, to using other shared financial techniques. And I believe there could be something here, whatever the name is, akin to opportunity cost. I mean, I went to business school, a very highly esteemed international business school that Arthur D. Little mounted in the 70s, actually. And so I have, and plus working in the industry, I have the language and the terminology down, let's call it. And I urge your audience also to invest time to learn the language of money, learn the language of finance. Even as it becomes, as we say, cashless and invisible, the principles will still operate. And the terminology will still be there. Maybe some new terms will come about blockchain and cryptocurrency as we see. But coming back, so the idea is, how can we incentivize you to recognize when you're making a financial decision that you have choices? The debt choice is an obvious one, but maybe they're slightly less obvious, where you will gain some emotional intelligence. You will gain some inner stability. You see where I'm getting at? So it comes to the fact that every financial decision we choose to make, whether it's the household or the business, it has mindset consequences. And that's the reason I wrote the book called Conscious Wealth.
Got it. So first of all, where can people go to access that book?
Yeah, well, thank you, Thomas. So it's on Amazon. Okay. And there's an ebook version, there's a Kindle version, there's a paperback, and if you order the hard copy, I'll sign it for you.
Awesome, awesome. And secondly, so in that regard, would you say that the most important thing people need to do is to limit the distractions? Because in order for you to think, you have to be able to limit your distractions, right? And we live in a very distracted world.
Amon Merchant, a dear friend and one that my youngest daughter helped build in Dubai, Impact Hub, back in maybe about 12 years ago. And I was there working the entrepreneurs. You mentioned mentorship. I mentored them, and I continue to mentor in different places here and there, trying to be helpful to the fintechs. But yes. Distraction is something that he now has a world-class program, which I commend. You can find him on YouTube, Amon Merchant. And this is a major challenge today for our young people and even others. I mean, you use the word distraction very carefully, because it's shown that whatever 65% of the people that go to work every day are distracted. Right? Mm-hmm. They bring their mobile phone and they're checking this and that, nothing to do with the productivity of the business that they're in. It's a major, major problem. And in some people, unfortunately, it rises perhaps to the level of addiction, is they need to be liked. What Peter Sage, another mentor and a marvelous thinker, he uses the word goop. Maybe you've heard of that. G-O-O-P, which is that we drive our decisions and our behavior into the goop, the good opinion of others, or the good opinion of other people, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's a trap.
Be yourself. Be yourself. And yes, try the best you can to be undistracted, to be true to your heart, true to your mission. And if that's not clear, then I strongly suggest you take a long weekend, or maybe get a mentor or somebody trusted that can help you do some self-discovery. Because, you know, some people are living the same day over and over and over until retirement.
Yeah, and that's the hamster wheel effect right there.
And life is precious. Life is an adventure. Life is really, it's a gift.
Yes, indeed. It's definitely a gift. So if someone were to inquire about your services or just want to connect with you, where can they go to access you, Dr. Omar?
Yeah, thank you. So I have a website as author, which is omarfisher.com. I can give you my email, which is omar@consciouswealth.me, Middle East, M-E. You can be in touch with me there. And by the way, before I leave, I would like to extend a gift also. You say that at the outset, you're going to be giving some, sending books out to Cambodia.
Yeah, it's part of B1G1.
Mm-hmm. But could I add to that? So this is a one you can find on Amazon.
Okay, it's a bit blurry. The title's a bit blurry.
Yeah, how do I? There it goes.
Okay, there it's going back and forth. So live, just read the title. It's Living Something. The title's a bit blurry right now. Yeah.
That's strange. Okay, so it's The Art of Living Well.
Okay, now I see it. Okay, The Art of Living Well and The Science of Happiness.
Correct.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
A short, you know, it's maybe about 50 pages, ebook, which I'm happy to send you a version, and then you can send it digitally to those in Cambodia. The purpose of this short ebook is to help us pause and to think about our life, what we like, what maybe we want to change, and then give some advice and perhaps some direction on how to bring happiness and what I call permanent happiness, by the way, permanent happiness, bring it closer. Isn't that what we're all seeking at the end of the day?
Yes, indeed. Fulfillment and happiness. That's the end goal right there, you know? Yeah. But Dr. Omar, I'd like to thank you for coming on to this episode of How May I Serve You. Thank you for your wisdom, your energy, you know, and your wealth of knowledge, you know. And also, I'd like to thank all of our guests, all our listeners and viewers for lending us their ears and their eyeballs. But last but not least, Dr. Omar, I have one more question for you. And that is, how may I serve you?
Well, first off, you've already done it. So by inviting me on the podcast and honoring me to be part of the long line of interesting people of our age who are in their own way making certain contributions. And that's, you know, that's part of the richness, I would say, of not only our community here in the United States, where we're an amalgam of different historicities and you know, ethnic lineage and so forth, different practices. What we need is, in my opinion, is more tolerance. That's what we need. So how you can serve me going forward is stay in touch. Let us continue to collaborate in whatever way makes sense, to share these kinds of positive ideas, because what I perceive, Thomas, is these are dark times. A lot of uncertainty, both economic and geopolitical, and people need to be supported. They have to feel valuable. They have to feel acknowledged. And so that's our work. And going forward, whatever else you can do with your work to promote, and I'm not saying you're not doing it, but continue and enrich it to promote tolerance, inability for us to work together, to want to work together, and to improve overall life, okay, and the level of consciousness.
Yes, indeed.
We have entered, I don't know if you're aware, but astrologically, humanity has entered the age of Aquarius, finally. And the age of Aquarius is a time of knowledge. It's a time for the evolution of the consciousness and the orderly intelligence that flows through each of us and through and across the universe. We have left the age of information. We've left the age of data processing. So yes, computers are here, and they're going to be a bigger, and robotics is going to be a bigger part of our future, but I'm talking about one level up. And it's up to us to fulfill that promise, that potential, which our Creator has given to each of us through the gifts and talents that we have.
Amen, amen. So Dr. Omar, once again, thank you for blessing us with your knowledge. And if you guys enjoyed this episode, please feel free to share it with someone else that will benefit. And make sure to tune in for next week's episode. Be blessed, take care, and we're out. Cheers.